And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That music can mean only one thing, that we are going to be talking for the next few minutes on the morning show about one of the great towering masterworks in the history of music, Messiah, by George Frederick Handel. A great masterpiece by any measure, and certainly a work that has come to be a very important part of the cultural landscape here in southeastern Wisconsin for a couple of different reasons. For one, for the annual sing-along Messiah, and for another, the performances of Messiah that have occurred on a nearly yearly basis at the University of Wisconsin Parkside under the loving guidance of Dr. James Kinchin, the director of choral activities there. This year's performances of Messiah are special for another reason. And that is because they are being performed in memory of someone who was a towering figure in the history of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And I'm speaking of Francis Bedford, who for nearly a quarter century was a treasured member of the music faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And her favorite instrument was the harpsichord. And she was at the harpsichord for every single performance of Handel's Messiah for more than two decades. And she passed away on April 6, 2023. And these performances are being given in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall and are dedicated to her memory. And on the stage, playing oboe, as he has for the last decade or so, is her son, Monty Bedford, who has had a distinguished career of his own in music, a marvelous oboist, and as a matter of fact, concertized extensively with his mother across the country and abroad as well as the Bedford Duo. And I'm so pleased that we have Monty Bedford joining us for the next few minutes to talk primarily about his wonderful mother, her amazing legacy, and also about the musical life and collaboration that they enjoyed together for so many, many years. We do want to say, before we go any further, that the performances of Handel's Messiah at Parkside will be taking place Saturday evening, December 7th at 7 p.m. and Sunday afternoon, December 8th at 3 p.m. in Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And Monty Bedford, we welcome you to the morning show.
I thank you very much for this opportunity.
I'm grateful for this chance to finally meet you after all these years, after having certainly heard about you. And I know we are mostly here to talk about your mother, but maybe ahead of that, you could at least sketch for our listeners something of your own life, which has included many, many years of professional music making.
Thank you. Yes, I had a career in music almost a quarter of a century as an oboe professor at Penn State University was my first gig, as they say. I was oboe professor and also woodwind coach there. And then later I transferred to University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa, and had a similar career there, and it worked out quite well. I got tenure there. So, and later I played with orchestras, including Indianapolis Symphony. I played over 400 concerts with them. Actually, at this time of the year, I would be playing in their Christmas concert series, which had probably already started. I remember years in which I played 25 performances. It was quite the long slog. But anyway, fond memories. Professor Francis, my mother, and I did some excellent touring around the Midwest. Wisconsin Arts Council sponsored us in many activities, including going out to the workshops in the schools. And we all played in the southern states, some of the southeastern states, and also in three tours in Europe. So, and I remember we would perform, let's see, this listening locale, the southeastern Wisconsin, we would, Lake Forest College, Forest at Parkside, Alverno College, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, West Bend, Kohler Center, I remember, and we went out into the schools based on Wisconsin Arts Council funding. So yes, we and also throughout Wisconsin. So,
tell us a little bit about the way in which you came to choose the oboe, or if it's maybe one of those stories of the oboe choosing you, and also, was it just kind of a foregone conclusion with a mother like Frances Bedford, that you were going to be pursuing music one way or another?
Well, the foregone conclusion, I think, took the form of there were three of us children, and it was a given that we would sing together. We would have Sunday evening get-togethers at the piano every week, where Fran, mom, would play piano, we would all sing and sing in four-part harmony. It was a foregone conclusion that we would all sing and sing in our respective parts. And so that was going on. And also it was a foregone conclusion that we would be playing piano, and another foregone conclusion that we would pick another instrument. That was, unless we were to specialize in piano, but that was not the case. Another instrument, and my older brother Eric picked horn, and then I picked oboe after having put the violin, my dad was a violinist, after having put the violin up to my chin and realized, oh, this is just, it's not cushy on my collarbone here, and I sort of struggled with that, and then I said, well, I'm not too happy here, and then I ended up getting to the oboe, which I heard, it might have been an English horn that I actually heard, but I really liked the sound, and then they somehow decided, okay, that's the instrument. So I started, actually, at 8 years old, I was too young to play the oboe because the hand position, I just couldn't, my fingers could not spread to cover all the keys, and so I started on a soprano saxophone. And the actually, it was my brother's horn teacher who had this instrument somewhere. It was a rather antique kind of saxophone in C. Now, a soprano saxophone is normally in B flat, and it's a straight instrument. This was a curved soprano saxophone in C, which is, if you ask saxophone players, some of them have it like, what? Rarely is it seen, but it was sort of an antique from either the 20s or the 30s. But that's what I started on, played in the jazz band, as well as the normal, classical pieces. And then when I was 9, I started the oboe. Eventually, I graduated, got a bachelor's and master's degree from Wisconsin-Madison.
Wonderful. I wonder, just retreating back to your mother, Frances Bedford,
Yes. Do
you know very much about how she came to, first of all, love music in general, and then in particular, how she ended up gravitating towards the harpsichord as her primary instrument for most of her professional life?
Right. She also came from a musical family, and everyone played. This is in a small town in northwest Missouri called Oregon, and they would have a town square and a town band, and all of the kids, all of her four kids from her family would play a band instrument, as well as Dad. Avon would play the horn, and actually he was a farmer in his entire life. He was a graduate of University of Missouri in Columbia, and actually at one point when St. Louis Symphony came to town, played there, they asked for a horn player. He stepped up and played in the section, and he was in college at this point, and before they had left town, they actually had offered him a job with the St. Louis Symphony, which, because his father had sent him to college to learn agriculture and be a farmer, he felt obligated to say no. Anyway, it's a good story, which is true. So Francis played piano and an organ in the church, Presbyterian church in town, ever since, I don't know how young, very young. And she was also a clarinetist. She majored in piano at Wisconsin, University of Missouri. And where she got a bachelor's degree. And then we were in the Washington, D.C. area for quite a while. She got some classes at George Washington University, played a lot of, she would be teaching class piano in the setting of, you know, many piano students would be in the class and would teach in that way instead of a individual piano teacher-student relationship. It would be a class, so it's called class piano. And that's what she did, and it's a good way to go because you have an obligation. You need to learn piano if you're a music major or if you're simply interested in basic piano. So the most efficient way is to teach it in a class of, I don't know, 5, 6, or 7, I would suppose. So she learned to do that at George Washington University. Then we had a big move to Carbondale, Illinois, where Dad Emmett Bedford, who became a Parkside English professor eventually, so when he went to pursue his master's and then PhD in English, then of course Fran Mom would got busy and got together with the music department. She eventually got a master's degree at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and that's where she got even more experience teaching class piano. At that point, she overlapped with a harpsichord player, Wes Lee Morgan. Dr. Morgan was the teacher there, and he taught her harpsichord. She got pretty good at it, and then they had a interact with the Collegium Musicum that was from University of Chicago. They actually eventually recorded a Pleiades brand label recording, and she had those experiences. And so when in 1970 Dr. Emmett G. Bedford professor was hired at Parkside, the next thing that happened was that she was approached by somebody, I guess apparently in the music department, thinking, okay, so you're a wife, you're a faculty wife, and it's a really a great and expected thing that a faculty wife would would contribute out of the goodness of her heart and empty purse to teach at Parkside class piano. And of course she's has a master's degree in music, fully qualified, lots of experience, and she basically said, well, thank you. If you're hiring, I'm interested. So she was actually hired, even though she was expected to do everything free of charge as a faculty wife. Personally, she was a very, what would I say, easygoing, very kind person, not to speak out boldly too much, but she was also very firm in what she believed. And at any rate, the hiring did take place at that point. And the rest is, of course, became full professor, and she wrote a very fine book on 20th century harpsichord music, and I think that was a huge tome where she did a massive amount of research. So I think that's another thing that should be mentioned about her harpsichord work. And she played in many places and was a concerto performer.
Right. She was wonderful. I feel privileged to have seen her in action and even shared the stage with her a time or two. Before we bring in Dr. James Kinchin to talk about Messiah, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your father, Emmett Bedford, who himself had a really interesting life and interesting professional career, which I'm sure in turn made life interesting for your mother as well.
Well, thank you. Yes. So he was born and raised in Columbia, Missouri, in the Depression, and life really, really was tough. His father actually became disabled from a terrible accident in the barn on the farm, and So, but they managed, and there were three boys, and eventually they all went to the local University of Missouri there in Columbia, and that's where he eventually met Fran when he came back. He was still in uniform. He came back from on leave from the war. This is during World War II, and he was a violinist. And she was a cellist at that time, and she got a chance to meet him in the orchestra. Eventually, he graduated with a degree in music and also a degree in journalism. And from journalism, he then was hired in Kansas City at the newspaper, and then Salt Lake City, their newspaper, and eventually was, through a contact, then was hired in Washington, D.C. to be a journalist. He first worked at the Congressional Quarterly, where he had a column that would explain various legislation that would be passed, and from there he would explain in simpler terms to the public, you know, what's the meaning of this bill that's been passed, and he had a column there. After that, he was hired by the Washington Post, and he was a editor at the Post, and then was hired ultimately by the Washington Star, which is actually the premier at that time, was the premier paper in that city, and it was considered number two in the country. After he had been there for a while, he was interested in getting further education to get a master's and a PhD, so he eventually got an opportunity in Carbondale at Southern Illinois University. And so then he went there, got a master's, changed over into English literature, and got a PhD. He was the first English literature PhD at SIU that they ever had. So they wanted to make sure things were right, so they made it extra hard for him. Eventually, he passed all his exams and graduated in 1970. He was a scholar for Alexander Pope and the 18th century restoration, and 18th century was his specialty. So he got hired at Parkside and had a career there.
Very good, until his death in 2000. Well, Dr. James Kinchin, who is director of choral activities, has joined our conversation at this point. And Dr. Kinchin, I think it would be nice to hear from you your recollections of Francis Bedford as a faculty colleague at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Was she already there when you came, or were you already there when she came?
No, she preceded me, and I'm pleased to say, and first, good morning to both of you. It's just a delight to be able to join our conversation this morning. She was very much here, and there's a story. So when I was in the process of being hired, you know, which includes being vetted and interviewed, and then at some point they decide that they want to bring you in. And so what we generally do with candidates for positions is we bring them in for an interview and we put them up at a hotel. That was not the case for me. One of the members of the faculty hosted me, and in that person's home. And that person happened to have been Fran Bedford. Mm. So that was just tremendous. And I just felt really special. And I told a group in a rehearsal recently that next morning, Fran Bedford fixed me breakfast before driving me to campus. So that was my first contact with her. She was very welcoming. And I felt all the more that this was a good possibility for me to do what I did, to do what I'm doing musically and professionally, in part because of her warm welcome. Yes.
Mm. Love it.
She was here. She greeted me.
So tell us the sort of force of nature that she was as a part of the music faculty.
Oh, she was amazing. And in our meetings, where we worked out a lot of the details of how curriculum was supposed to work and how we were supposed to have various policies governing how we made music and how we did all of the things that departments do. She was always a consequential player. Fran would always, and she didn't have a whole lot to say ever, but when she said what she said, everybody listened. And we knew that there was something of value that was going to come. And often it would sway the decision in a different direction because of her, I would describe it as sagacious contributions to our deliberations. She's very much respected, and respected by students as well, as a teacher who was very much on their side, very much wanted them to learn, but at the same time had high standards and was pretty firm in how she ran her class.
Hmm. One of the things I appreciated about her is the fact that because the harpsichord was her primary instrument, and obviously we associate a certain era of music with that particular instrument, it always struck me as a wonderful surprise, and I guess I should not have been surprised, but nevertheless I was perpetually surprised when I would see Fran Bedford at performances that had nothing to do with the Baroque era, but that she was thoroughly immersed in and thoroughly enjoying, and also very conversant in. I mean, she knew so much about music, even beyond sort of the sphere of music that was her primary home artistically. And I think her far-reaching appreciation for music in so many different variants, that's one of the things I probably most admired about her.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I guess that that Professor Monty Bedford is probably better equipped to comment on this. But I think that that kind of curiosity that you're speaking about, and certainly it went into different avenues and different fields and different areas of music. But I think in general that one sensed about her a deep curiosity about life, about things. And I think that that is one of the things that made her just such a wonderful person, even after she retired, even after she was no longer on the faculty with us. She was really engaged with a lot of things around her.
Hmm. Monty Bedford, yeah, it'd be wonderful to hear from you about that aspect of your mother and her character.
Well, you'd mentioned music beyond harpsichord. I mean, she had a knowledge of probably just about any piece that was popular, especially composed in the first half of the 20th century. You could sing a couple of notes, and then she would say, "Oh yeah, that's such and such," and name the tune. And then she would, depending on what it was, she might know the first verse, maybe the second or third. And it was pretty amazing what she had picked up when she was young, and all the way through her entire life, things were important. Now I won't say that by the time the rock era came around, I'm not claiming she was an authority there, but in terms of anything from the early 20th century, 20s, 30s, 40s, she knew the bands, and that was something she could name for you and sing for you, and knew all the tunes. And she, I mean, it was, whether it was words or the music, she was on it.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about one aspect of the concertizing that you did with your mom as the Bedford duo, and that is the fact that my understanding is that, although I'm sure quite a lot of what you composed was performed came from the classical, perhaps Baroque period, and maybe early Romantic, or who knows, but that the two of you actually commissioned quite a number of brand new works to be composed expressly for you. And I think that also says a lot about, well, both of you, but I'm thinking especially of your mom and her interest in new music being created and performed.
Yes, we premiered quite a few pieces, actually. When we played in concert, the repertoire that we played would be probably almost or about half 20th century. Lawrence Moss, I'm trying to think, Wilt Bocci, We even had some Gershwin arrangements for oboe and harpsichord. I'm probably the only ones, but this is the kind of thing that we would have for every single concert. Yeah. Wow. Along with, so we would intersperse that with Baroque works.
Wow.
Tried to bring a lot of wide variety to the performances.
I remember reading in your mother's obituary when it referenced these concert tours that the two of you undertook, both here and abroad as well, that some of those concerts even took you behind the old Iron Curtain. I wonder what memories you have of some of those memorable experiences and some of the extraordinary places that your concert tours ended up taking you.
Yeah, I remember being in Bucharest, and we were in the Grand Hotel, and we would think, and we still probably believe that there were microphones probably in the behind the wallpaper or somewhere in there, and we would always wonder about that and laugh about that. We would where was it in Czechoslovakia, we were in the embassy there, and the place looked like a fortress, and that was pretty amazing. Like, the top looked like it was bomb-proof from any maybe airplane assault, but I don't know. I remember in Novi Sad, again, that was with the American embassy, but I mean, I was just a happy-go-lucky touristy type thinking person, but there was an interesting American embassy there, and so I went across the street, whipped out my camera because I like to take pictures, taking a picture, and the guy ran over. No, you can't do that. You can't take a picture of this. Is the American embassy. You can't do that. Let's see, what else were, okay. Another story would be in Luxembourg, there's a small town called Diekirch, outside of the main urban area, and it was an old monastery when we were playing, and I remember, I mean, very, very old, from, we're talking medieval monastery. There was sort of in the floor, like these metal grates that you have to let the air up, but you could actually see through the grate, and I was playing along, and I looked down, and I could actually look at the bones of the saints from the monastery, medieval monastery, as I was playing along, and I thought, wow, that's really something. in Saarbrücken in Germany, I remember, so when we showed up, these were tough times. These were in the mid-80s, and Americans weren't always totally loved everywhere. We actually got a bomb threat for our concert, and as it turns out, no one came because it was, well, there could be a bomb there, so who's going to come? Well, on the other hand, they allowed us to play the concert, so basically we performed for the people who were putting us on, and also the janitor came and listened to the entire concert, but we went ahead anyway, and it was in the spirit of the thing. There were other times, though, that was not the case in Novi Sad. That's in Yugoslavia, the former, before it was split up. There were like several hundred people in the audience for that one, so it varied a lot. In Paris, on the other hand, we were just uniformly boycotted. So it ran from one extreme to the other. Sometimes we got a lot of audience, and sometimes we didn't. Sort of just depended. And Edinburgh was quite appreciated. We played for the International Double Reed Society meeting. And we got a good review in that, so that was very helpful. So those are a few things.
Well, and how lovely for you to have this kind of experience with your mother. I mean, there's not a whole lot of people who get to say that they have gone on concert tours with their own parent. And I should think in doing that, you you get to know one another even better, and probably come to an even deeper understanding and admiration for each other.
Sure, that's absolutely the case. Sure, I remember when, you know, it was a question of forming the Bedford Duo. I was a Penn State faculty member, and one of the concerts, you know, you're expected to play recitals, of course, and I did. That first recital, I asked if she would play with me. I believe the entire concert was on with harpsichord at that point. Later, as a footnote, when we were in Europe, there was no way we could lug a harpsichord around. I mean, it does have some physical, it doesn't fold into your suitcase. We did play on piano, but at that point, she was playing harpsichord, and then based on that success, she started to get the idea that, well, maybe we could do more of this, and she was looking for her building up. I mean, all professors, this is true for every single one of them. I mean, if you are on a tenure track, if you're now fortunate enough to be on tenure track, and many are not, then you're looking to how to build your career, how to build your dossier, and, you know, what am I doing to show either research or, in the case of a performing artist, it's a performance if you will, in lieu of or the research itself. So she was looking for performances, and it is possible to play solo harpsichord, but this is better to get together as we did. It just works better. So she was saying, hey, you know, we could do this. And I'm thinking, oh, come on, Mom. You know, I've got lots to do. I'm playing in a resident quintet. You know, I'm playing in orchestras, you know. But, you know, we did get together. You know, we worked that out. We did get together, and I joined her. And she was certainly the spearhead, the guiding force. And she did book all the concerts by herself. Eventually, we did get an agent, and that was very helpful. A lady named Loretta, who was in the Kenosha, Waukesha area. And that's the way we went.
Hmm. And at least roughly, how many concerts did you end up playing together, and over the course of how many years? Again, just at least a rough estimate.
Oh, boy, I don't know. That's a really tough one. So we were playing in the 76, I was appointed to at Penn State. We might have played that year, maybe the next year, probably. Well, no, but I mean, we were playing together before that when I was still at Madison, and my years there were 72 to 76. We played there, and then we went up until about, I think, 85 or 86, so about a decade.
Wow.
I don't know how many, dozens, let's just say dozens, easily dozens. There were, in Europe alone, I should have this number, you know, but I would say maybe a dozen, somewhere between a dozen and 20, maybe halfway between those two.
Wow. Wonderful. What a legacy. For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today primarily about the great Francis Bedford, the late Francis Bedford, who passed away in early April 2023. And this weekend's performances of Handel's Messiah, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m., will take place in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall. And these performances are in her memory. Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at Parkside, will be on the podium conducting these performances, and Monty Bedford will be playing oboe for these performances. So, Dr. Kinchin, what are your memories? Before that, I want to ask you actually about your memories of collaborating with Francis Bedford, very specifically on Messiah, but also maybe you could summarize at what point Handel's Messiah began to figure so prominently in the musical life at UW Parkside. At what point did you feel like you and your musical forces were ready to tackle this great oratorio?
I'd begun thinking about it as early as 1992, And actually, and I won't get into the weeds of this story, it was a trip that I took with some choral colleagues to Sweden that really solidified my resolve to do it. I had an opportunity to meet with one of the finest Baroque choral experts, Anders Ervo, in Stockholm. And we had a brief conversation, but it was hugely impactful. And so I came away with the resolve to do it. And so I, to be honest with you, I approached Fran a little bit sort of gingerly because, you know, I didn't know that she would even want to be bothered with this, you know, this idea that I had of doing not just the quote unquote Christmas section. And you and I both know that technically there is not a Christmas section, but doing this entire oratorio from beginning to end. And I didn't know that that would be of particular interest to her, or that it would fit into the schedule of her myriad life activities. And she thought about it, and she said, "Yes, I'd like to do that." And I was just so incredibly honored. So it was in December of 1993 that we did the first of our Messiahs, we did them then on a 3-year cycle. You know, 93, 96, 99, and so forth. When we got to 2020, we were basically shut down because of COVID. So that would have been the next year to do Messiah. So we waited a year and made it 2021, which happened to have been our last Messiah performance, and also the last one that Fran was able to play with us. So we have the proud distinction of saying that every Messiah performance we've done, and I should keep better count, but it's been over 30 of them in that time, starting in 1993. Every one that we've done, Fran Badford played harpsichord.
Wow. So this set of performances tomorrow night and Sunday afternoon will be, in a sense, strange and bittersweet, because you will be undertaking this work for the first time without that lovely, familiar face at the harpsichord.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, she was so deeply knowledgeable about the style and about practices, performance practices, that was not anything that you ever really needed to address. She just did what she needed to do, and you were just really grateful. One was grateful for the reassurance that she was there presiding at the harpsichord. And listeners ought to appreciate this, that during Handel's lifetime, Handel led Messiah performances from the harpsichord. That was where he sat, that was where he played. And in fact, the very final performance that he led 6 days before his passing in 1759, he was sitting at the harpsichord. And I have in my program notes the very sobering fact that the performance that took place after his death, they had a list of people who were being paid and the amounts of money that each person was receiving. And there was a Thomas Bramwell who was not being paid. And the notation said, this Mr. Handel's servant is not being paid. Because that was his job. You know, Handel at that point, of course, had lost his eyesight, and so he led Handel to the harpsichord, and Handel would lead the performance.
Wow.
But it is very bittersweet. But I would also say that we are honored that we will still have a Bedford on the stage at Bedford Hall.
Hmm. And Monty Bedford, I would love to hear just a little bit about how you came to be a part of this tradition at Parkside, that is, to play in a number of these Messiah performances beginning back in 2014. How did that happen, and what are some of your memories of this particular collaboration?
Well, thank you. Yes, in 2014, I was asked to play, and I had... I think I mentioned before, maybe just to you, but I had previously been quite busy with the Indianapolis Symphony, and during the Christmas time, there were, as I said, 25 performances would be typical. I mean, it was just from Thanksgiving all the way up to Christmas. I mean, I could not. There was no way to get away. I did that for many, many years. But in 2014, I was no longer doing that, so I had an opportunity, and I was asked. So I was thrilled to play at Parkside. And so for some of those years, I think that first one, maybe two of them, Leslie Michalik also played in the oboe section with me. That she's my stepsister, based on her being the daughter of Fran's second husband, Richard Outland. And that was a great, great collaboration and marriage. She joined me then, and I think for at least a couple of years, performances being every third year. And I remember those things fondly. And also I can recall the very last time that a performance of Messiah in the 2021, and there was a reception at Parkside, lovely receptions. Oh, it's just great. Such a nice facility there. At the reception, Fran was asked to get up and say a word, and she was 97 at that time and had just finished playing the entire Messiah from, and the harpsichord plays every single note. I mean, every single note in the entire piece from beginning to end. And she got up and said how thrilled she was, and said that also she looked forward to playing again at age 100. Of course, would be her age had she survived at that point. But life is what it is. So, but she had full intentions of going all the yardage, the full nine yards. So I remember that fondly when she, wow. but she would have turned 100 this September.
Wow.
So I have lots of fond memories. And of course the beautiful, outstanding Bedford Hall is really something too. It was a thrill to be playing in that hall. So those are my thoughts. And I do have a couple of ideas if we get time to mention some things about the hall, but that could be a talk.
We have about 2 minutes left. If you want to say something about that beautiful hall, please do so.
Well, it is really truly outstanding, and it was a person to was hired to make it acoustically just marvelous. Fran was frustrated. Many people were that. There was no real facility for music performance. I think it was a talent hall, I think. Or it was really a theater. And I played there with the Bedford Duo. And so we really needed a musical space. She then very generously put forward money, said, look, here's we can now afford it. And then Madison, of course, had to. They weren't, I won't say anything, but it wasn't forthcoming. But with her putting forth that generous offer, so they went ahead and created the Bedford Hall. And then afterwards, it was then discovered, she looked at the register where her contribution was, and she expected a balance to be zero. And the balance was not zero. And apparently, they had gone ahead and created the hall anyway with Madison funds. And then after that, seeing the money still there, then that rolled over into the scholarships. So that actually whole money became the scholarship money, which were about maybe a dozen scholarships. And I think that was a real contribution.
Wow. And it is an absolutely stunning space. As someone who teaches at nearby Carthage College, I am envious every single time I am in that space, whether as an audience member or once in a while on the stage. And it is a beautiful place to make music and to experience music. Dr. Kinchin, in our last minute or so...
I was just going to say, we're humbly grateful for that space.
I should think so. Remind our listeners about exactly when these Messiah performances are taking place this weekend.
These performances will take place in stunning Bedford Hall on Saturday, which is December 7th at 7 p.m., and again on Sunday, December 8th at 3 p.m.
Very good. And we hope people will go to uwp.edu to seek out ticket information so they can be part of these very special performances of Messiah that are being performed in loving memory of Francis Bedford. Monty Bedford, it was great to meet you today on the morning show and to hear your own story and to hear your recollections of your mother. Thank you so much for being part of this. And Dr. James Kinchin, it's always great to speak with you as well. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you and all of your musicians doing Messiah this weekend. Coming up this weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, tomorrow, well-known financial planner Jane Bryant Quinn talking about her book, How to Make Your Money Last. And then on Sunday, again out of the archives, from way back in 2002, a conversation with Dr. Linda Harper about her book, Give to Your Heart's Content Without Giving Yourself Away. Looking ahead to our broadcast schedule for next week for The Morning Show, on Monday, you'll hear the conversation I recorded with Joseph Tenuta, who is an assistant professor of marketing and management at Carthage and the author of a book called The Starting Blueprint, What You Can Expect When Starting Your Own Business. On Tuesday, we return to Musical Matters with Doug Johnson, who is the conductor of the Bell City Brass Works, such a wonderful organization. They have a couple of different holiday concerts coming up over the next couple of weeks, and we'll be talking about that. On Wednesday, you'll hear my conversation with Debbie Slevin, the author of a book called Unpregnant Pause, Where Are the Babies? The book examines the modern trends of lowering birth rates, that is, fewer and fewer women bearing children at all, and of those that do bear children, how so many are bearing fewer children than was once commonplace, and what is behind some of these trends. A really, really interesting, intriguing book. You'll hear about it this Wednesday. On Thursday, Kaylin Palomares pays her monthly visit to the program. We will be talking about conservation with two of her colleagues from Racine County, Chad Sampson and John Grove. And this coming Friday, so a week from today, once again we talk about Messiah. Again, it's being performed this coming weekend at UW Parkside. But then on Sunday, December 15th, it's the Sing-Along Messiah, a treasured tradition here in southeastern Wisconsin. That occurs at First United Methodist Church. And we will be talking with Jessica DeBoer, who is the coordinator of that event. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And if you're interested in hearing the podcast version of The Morning Show, look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Our weather forecast calls for a mostly sunny sky today. Chilly out there with a high of 31 degrees, but our winds have calmed down considerably. Overnight, some clouds roll in with a low of 22 degrees. Tomorrow begins a fairly dramatic warming trend. Daytime highs tomorrow in the mid-40s, and we will see the low 50s for a high by Friday, with a chance of some rain showers developing on Monday, and mild temperatures expected to continue for several days. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and